Welcome to Scaling Legends, the podcast where growth-minded construction leaders unlock the systems and strategies behind building generational companies. This is Deep Dive, the segment where we uncover how real founders are scaling from 5 million to 50 million and beyond without losing control of quality, culture, or cash flow. Today's episode is brought to you by SmartBusinessAutomator.com, the operations engine behind modern construction firms that want to scale smarter, not harder. If you're dealing with project delays, chaotic scheduling, dropped balls on follow-ups, or manual bottlenecks, Smart Business Automator helps you automate back-office workflows and change order follow-ups, streamline subcontractor coordination and client communication, track bids, leads, and financials in one clean dashboard. Free up your time to focus on building, hiring, and closing bigger deals. Because in construction, scale without systems is just stress. Now, let's deep dive.
Welcome to Urban Truth, the podcast that cuts through the noise to examine how New York City's policies actually impact real people. I'm your host, and today we're talking about something that touches hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers, the NYC Housing Lottery. If you've ever scrolled through those Housing Connect listings dreaming of, you know, a rent-stabilized apartment in Manhattan for under $2,000, you're definitely not alone. But behind those glossy renderings and hopeful applications lies, well, a complex web. Good intentions, systemic flaws, and even outright corruption. It's creating this kind of two-tiered system where the people who need help the most are often left behind. Today, we'll break down what the housing lottery was supposed to do, what's actually happening, and crucially, if you're thinking about applying, what you need to know to navigate this system effectively. Okay, let's unpack this. So the NYC housing lottery, it wasn't meant to be just a quick fix, right? Not a Band-Aid?
No, not at all. The vision was much bigger.
It was envisioned as this comprehensive tool meant to create economically diverse communities, ensure working families could actually afford to live in the city. That was the promise.
Mm-hmm. The equity promise was central. The idea was a random lottery. Your income decided which apartments you could apply for, but luck, pure chance, was supposed to determine the winners.
Not connections.
Exactly. The goal was explicitly to get rid of those sort of backroom deals, that feeling that someone always knew someone.
And then there was the integration piece, the integration promise.
Yeah, through programs like Mandatory Inclusionary Housing or MIH.
Right. So new developments, especially in those gentrifying neighborhoods, they were required to include affordable units. The idea was to stop displacement, you know, foster real mixed income communities.
That was the theory. But you could already see the tension, right? In a city with such stark divides.
Definitely. And they also promised simplicity.
Ah, yes, the simplicity promise. That brought us Housing Connect.
It was
the website. A one-stop online portal. Create your profile once, apply to multiple lotteries, supposedly much easier than the old way.
Which involved stacks of paper running around.
Oh, yeah. Cumbersome paper applications. It was meant to democratize access, make it easier for everyone.
And developers had to be brought on board. There was a promise for them too.
Absolutely. The develop a partnership promise. This involved pretty significant financial incentives.
Like density bonuses.
All right, letting them build bigger buildings than zoning would normally allow, plus tax breaks, sometimes huge ones.
So the idea was, it's a win-win. Developers build these larger, more profitable projects, and the city gets affordable units, basically, without spending taxpayer money directly.
That was the theory. And the goal was ambitious. 200,000 affordable units over a decade, fair access for everyone. That was the vision.
Okay, so that's the promise. The shiny brochure version. Now, the reality.
Yeah, the reality is quite different. Let's look at the numbers. Recent data. We're talking 6 million applications for just 10,000 available units.
6 million for 10,000.
Do the math. That's 600 people competing for every single apartment.
600 to 1. Mm-hmm. Those odds are rough.
Yeah.
And I bet it's not even across the board, is it?
Not even close.
Yeah.
That's the income inequality reality. For the lowest rent apartments, the ones for folks making under, say, $30,000 a year, it's 650 applications per unit.
Wow.
But for the apartments aimed at people earning six figures, only 123 applications per unit.
So if you're really struggling financially, you're basically 6 times less likely to win than someone who's already doing okay.
That's what the data shows. It completely flips the script on who the system is actually helping most effectively.
And what about that integration promise? Creating mixed communities.
Well, that ran into major problems too. Segregation reality. There was a federal lawsuit, actually.
I remember hearing about that.
It forced the city to reduce something called community preference. It used to be 50% of units went to people already living in that community board district.
Which sounds reasonable on the surface.
But the lawsuit argued, successfully, that it was actually perpetuating racial segregation. It was concentrating affordable housing in already low-income, predominantly black and brown neighborhoods.
While keeping affordable options out of whiter, more affluent areas.
Exactly. So that preference had to be lowered down to 15%. It was a direct challenge to the idea that the system was fostering integration.
So even if you beat the odds, beat the 600-to-1 odds, you win. Then what? Is it smooth sailing?
Not quite. Then you hit the bureaucratic reality. Winning is just the start.
Boy.
You're facing potentially months of paperwork. 6 pay stubs, tax returns going back years, bank statements for every account.
6 pay stubs, that's 3 months of income verification.
Right, and the whole process from being selected to actually getting the lease signed can easily take over 100 days.
100 days, that's over 3 months just waiting and submitting documents.
It's incredibly grueling, so much so that a lot of winners, people who actually won the lottery, they just give up, they drop out.
That's heartbreaking. To get that notification and then get worn down by the process itself.
It really is. And then, let's say you get through that, you move in.
Okay.
Then you might encounter the management reality. We hear story after story about major building management issues in these lottery buildings.
Like what?
Things like brown water coming out of taps, elevators being broken for months on end, basic repairs taking forever. Often it seems like management only responds when tenants organize or, frankly, when the media gets involved.
So you win the lottery, navigate the bureaucracy, move in, and then you might have to fight for basic services.
It happens more often than you'd think. It adds another layer of stress onto what should be a moment of relief.
Okay, this is pretty sobering. Systemic flaws, bureaucracy.
Yeah.
But you mentioned corruption earlier. That takes it to another level.
Yeah, let's talk about the corruption. This is where it gets really concerning.
What are we seeing there?
Well, remember that big NYCHA bust? The contracting corruption? February 2024.
Oh yeah, that was huge news. 70 employees arrested.
70 NYCHA employees, yeah. Largest single day bribery takedown in DOJ history, apparently. They were taking cash bribes, small amounts mostly, $500, $2,000.
Pocket change almost, in the grand scheme of construction contracts.
Right, but it was to steer no bid work, small repair contracts usually, to specific contractors.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of dollars in contracts influenced by these small bribes.
And didn't one of the DAs say something really stark about that?
They did. The Brooklyn DA investigating related affordable housing issues said, and I'm quoting here, "We would have to be naive to think that these were the only apartments that were awarded through bribery. In fact, we actually believe that this was the norm, not the exception."
The norm, not the exception. That's chilling. It suggests it's not just a few bad apples.
It suggests a potentially systemic issue, yes. And then there's the whole process of choosing which developers get to build these projects in the first place.
The developer selection process.
Officially, it sounds very proper. HPD, the city's housing agency, issues RFPs, requests for proposals, developers submit plans. Selections are based on things like reliability, integrity, and financial capacity.
Those are good on paper.
But the reality can look different. There's the example of developer Peter Fine. He was actually temporarily banned from city housing programs. Hmm. Why?
Why?
For getting free architectural work from Adolfo Carrion Jr. back when Carrion was the Bronx borough president.
Okay, and Carrion is now.
Mayor Adams is housing commissioner, the guy overseeing HPD.
Oh.
And currently, Peter Fine, the same developer, is reportedly paying lobbyists to try and get support for new projects from Commissioner Carrion.
Certainly raises questions about access and influence, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And it feeds into the financial incentive problem.
Yeah.
The city needs developers to build this housing because they're relying on this private partnership model.
So they have to make the deal sweet enough.
Exactly. Which means those density bonuses, allowing much bigger buildings. Tax exemptions that can be worth millions, even tens of millions over time. Sometimes direct public subsidies, too.
But does that always result in housing that's truly affordable?
Often, no. especially not for the lowest income New Yorkers. Because, as one expert pointed out, inclusionary zoning, where developers include affordable units, it's basically voluntary. No profit-driven company is going to do it unless they expect a decent return on their investment.
Which leads to the city making concessions.
And sometimes those concessions mean the affordable units aren't that affordable. Which brings us to AMI.
Ah, yes, area median income. This seems to be a huge point of contention.
It's probably the most technically complex but fundamentally flawed part. The AMI gaming. How we define affordable is based on this AMI figure.
But the area isn't just New York City, right?
Exactly. That's the key. Yeah. It includes wealthy suburban counties like Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, even Fairfield County in Connecticut for some calculations.
So you're averaging in some of the richest areas in the country.
Right, which massively inflates the median income figure used for the city. So you end up with situations where a family of four making, say, $155,000 qualifies for many quote-unquote affordable units.
$155,000.
Yep.
That's not what most people think of as needing subsidized housing.
Meanwhile, someone actually making the median income in many city neighborhoods, maybe $25,000 or $30,000, they qualify for almost nothing. The units targeting that income level are incredibly scarce.
So it really makes you ask, who is this system actually designed to serve?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the people struggling the most, or is it more moderate income folks?
That's the central question the AMI issue raises. It seems skewed towards the latter.
Okay, so we've laid out the promises, the harsh realities, the potential for corruption. It sounds pretty bleak. But are there fixes? Can this be improved?
Well, yes. People are working on it. There are some immediate bureaucratic fixes happening right now, which is encouraging.
Like what?
The city just cut down that insane paperwork requirement. Instead of 6 months of pay stubs, applicants now only need to provide 1 month's worth.
That alone must make a big difference.
Huge. They're also rolling out a first-come, first-served system for units that become vacant after the initial lottery lease-up. This avoids apartments sitting empty while they run mini lotteries.
That makes sense. Get people in faster.
And there's new preference matching technology to ensure applicants are only contacted for units that actually fit their household size and income.
Right.
Less wasted time for everyone.
Those are good steps. Practical improvements. Mm-hmm. But what about the bigger structural issues, like AMI?
Right. Those require deeper structural changes. Reforming the AMI calculation is key. It needs to reflect actual New York City median incomes, not the entire wealthy metro area.
How likely is that? It seems politically difficult.
It is, because it involves federal HUD guidelines. But advocates are pushing hard. Another big idea is creating dedicated income bands within lotteries.
So separate pools.
Exactly. So low-income families making, say, under $50,000 aren't directly competing against moderate-income families making $120,000 for the same units. Each group competes within its own band.
That seems much fairer.
And then there's the need for much stronger oversight. Independent monitoring, perhaps, and definitely requiring public disclosure of communications between developers and city officials involved in approvals. More transparency.
Sunlight being the best disinfectant, maybe?
Perhaps. And thinking even bigger picture, there are long-term systemic solutions people are discussing.
Beyond just tweaking the current lottery and developer model.
Yes. Like public development, creating a city or state entity that can actually build affordable housing directly without needing to guarantee a private developer's profit margin.
Taking the profit motive out, essentially.
Or at least balancing it. Then there's social housing, looking at models like Vienna.
I've heard about Vienna's housing.
Right, where a huge percentage, like 60% of residents, live in high-quality, city-owned or regulated housing that isn't strictly means-tested. It's seen more as public infrastructure, available to a broad range of people.
A very different philosophy.
Very different. And another tool is community land trusts. Nonprofits acquire land and hold it permanently, leasing it out for affordable housing development. This keeps the land out of the speculative market forever.
So the housing stays affordable permanently, not just for 30 years or whatever the deal is.
That's the goal. These are bigger, more fundamental shifts being proposed.
Okay, so there are ideas out there, from small tweaks to major overhauls. But for you, listening right now, maybe you're thinking of applying or you've been applying for years, what's the practical advice?
Right. Let's talk application strategy. First off, apply. Apply to everything you're eligible for. It is lottery, it's random. More entries generally mean slightly better odds, even if the odds are long.
Cast a wide net.
Exactly. And consider focusing on outer boroughs or maybe less trendy neighborhoods. Competition can be lower there sometimes.
Makes sense.
Also, if you happen to qualify for moderate income lotteries, those higher AMI bands definitely apply to those too. Counterintuitively, the odds can sometimes be better because there are fewer applicants in those brackets compared to the huge demand at the lowest end.
Okay, good tip. Now, the documents. You mentioned the paperwork burden.
Yes. Document preparation is key. Don't wait until you win the lottery. Start gathering things now, or at least know where they are.
Like what specifically?
Recent pay stubs have a month or two ready. Your latest tax returns, bank statements for all accounts. If you have a regular income, like freelance work or gig work, document it meticulously. Keep records of everything.
What about things like gifts?
Good question. Gifts from family can count as income, and you need to declare it. Any income you don't declare that they find later can disqualify you, so be thorough and honest.
It sounds like you need to be incredibly organized.
You really do. It pays off if your log number gets called. Also, some red flags to avoid.
Okay, what scams are out there?
Number one, never ever pay anyone for help applying. The application process through Housing Connect is free. City-funded nonprofits offer free help too.
So anyone charging a fee is suspicious.
Highly suspicious. Be very wary of lottery consultants or anyone promising they can improve your chances. They can't. It's a random lottery.
They're just taking your money.
Pretty much. And a technical point, do not submit multiple applications for the same lottery listing. That will get all your applications for that building disqualified. One per household per lottery.
Got it. And maybe the most important advice.
Setting realistic expectations.
Manage your hopes.
Exactly. The odds, especially for those deeply affordable units, are genuinely objectively terrible. It's like playing the actual lottery sometimes.
So apply, but don't bank your entire future on it.
Please don't. And if you do win, remember that 100-day processing time. Don't give notice on your current place or make major plans until you have the keys in your hand. Seriously.
Wait till it's absolutely final.
Absolutely. And one more thing, building quality varies. If you get a chance, try to research the developer or the management company listed for the building. See if they have a good or bad reputation.
Do your homework if you can. Are there other avenues besides the main housing lottery?
Yes, definitely look into alternative strategies. There's the Mitchell-Lama program. These are older state-subsidized affordable co-ops and rentals. They have separate wait lists, often very long, but the rents or maintenance fees can be incredibly low if you get in.
Worth getting on those lists, even if it takes years.
Potentially, yes. Also, HDFC co-ops. These are unique buildings, Housing Development Fund Corporation co-ops. They offer affordable home ownership opportunities, not just rentals, but they have income restrictions too. It's a different path.
Owning instead of renting.
Right. And finally, remember that within the main lottery system, there are often specific set-asides or preferences for certain groups, like seniors, people with disabilities, and people transitioning out of homelessness. If you fall into one of those categories, make sure you indicate that on your application.
Okay, that's really helpful practical advice. Stepping back again, though, this whole system, the lottery, it feels like a symptom, doesn't it, of something bigger?
Oh, absolutely. It connects directly to the broader NYC housing shortage. You can't separate the two.
The vacancy rate numbers are shocking.
They really are. Citywide, the overall rental vacancy rate is about 1.4%. That's considered a crisis level. And for apartments renting under $2,400 a month, it's less than 1%.
Less than 1% vacancy for affordable places.
Basically, nothing is available. When housing is that scarce, any system you use to allocate the few available units is going to feel unfair, and it's going to be intensely competitive. The lottery is just trying to manage that scarcity.
But despite all the flaws we've talked about, it is creating some housing, right?
Yes, we have to acknowledge that. Over 10,000 new affordable apartments came online through the lottery system in the last year alone. That's 10,000 families who got stable, rent-regulated housing. That's not insignificant. It is making a difference for those individuals.
It's a real lifeline for the people who win.
A life-changing opportunity for many, but politically, the system is interesting.
How so?
Well, generating those 6 million applications, that immense visible demand, It actually provides a kind of political cover for elected officials.
How does that work?
They can point to the lottery winners, hold press conferences, showcase the success stories, and say, look, we're doing something about affordable housing.
While maybe avoiding tougher conversations.
Exactly. While avoiding the much harder, more politically fraught conversations about things like fundamental zoning reform across the city, massive public investment in housing, or tackling that really basic question. Should housing be treated primarily as a market commodity, or is it a fundamental human right the government has a duty to ensure? The lottery lets them focus on allocation, not necessarily on fundamentally increasing the supply or changing the market dynamics.
So wrapping this up, the NYC Housing Lottery, it's a strange mix, isn't it?
It really is. It embodies both the best intentions and maybe some of the worst outcomes of American housing policy.
Built on good ideas, opportunity, integration, preventing displacement.
Yeah, the promises were admirable, but the implementation.
Yeah.
Well, we've seen how it often ends up serving moderate income families better than the poorest families, how it sometimes reinforced segregation instead of fixing it.
And how it created these openings for bureaucratic nightmares and even outright corruption.
All of that is true. But my advice to listeners, if you're applying, keep applying.
Don't give up entirely.
Don't give up. The system has deep flaws, yes. But thousands of people do win every year. They get these life-changing housing opportunities. Just go into it with your eyes open. Understand the odds, the process, the potential pitfalls.
And for everyone else, the voters.
Remember, housing policy is overwhelmingly local policy. Your city council member, your borough president, the mayor. These are the people making the decisions about zoning, about investment, about how these programs run. They're on your ballot.
So pay attention.
Pay attention. The housing crisis won't be solved just by tweaking the lottery. It needs political leaders who are willing to make genuinely hard choices about how land is used, where money is invested, and ultimately, who gets to afford to live in New York City.
That's all for today's deep dive. If this helped you understand something new about housing in New York, maybe share it with someone who could use the info. And if you have your own housing lottery story, good, bad, frustrating, we'd genuinely love to hear from you. You can reach out through our website. Until next time, keep asking the hard questions.